morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, February 10th, 2006. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Jim Thompson.
Coming up on the KBOO Morning News, the Portland City Council voted to appeal a decision that allows PGE stocks to be distributed among its creditors. Teachers are facing blowback for protesting the Iraq war in the schools. And Scooter Libby told a federal grand jury that Dick Cheney authorized him to leak classified information. Today's Portland area weather, sunny, breezy, highs 55 to 60, lows 30 to 35.
The Portland City Council upped the ante this week in its ongoing struggle with Enron and Portland General Electric. The council voted to appeal a decision by Oregon's utility regulators to let the bankrupt former energy giant distribute PGE stock to its creditors. The resolution authorizes the city attorney to file a complaint with the Oregon Court of Appeals. Essentially, it will argue that the Oregon Public Utility Commission blew it when it approved the transaction to finally separate PGE from its troubled parent company. The city has consistently objected to the stock distribution and the resulting change in control of the utility. It has argued that the move fails to meet the legal requirement that the change in ownership deliver a net benefit to ratepayers. The city wants to keep its legal options open while it completes an ongoing investigation into PGE rates, questionable trading transactions that took place under Enron, and the utility's collection and payment of county and state taxes. Monday is the deadline for filing an appeal. It's unclear how long such an appeal will take or whether it will delay the first distribution of PGE stock. Enron plans to distribute 30% of PGE shares to creditors in April. The remainder will stay in a reserve for disputed claims until the claims are resolved. This from the Oregonian.
A Portland police officer who was injured while firing a handgun has filed a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against the manufacturers of the gun and the ammunition. According to the suit, Officer Florin Perv was taking a qualification test in March 2004 with a .45 caliber Glock 21 when the breech cartridge feed ramp fractured, causing a backward propulsion of hot gases, hot air, and shrapnel to be blown into Perv's face, body, and hands. The lawsuit names Glock and two ammunition makers, Federal Cartridge Company and Alliant Technosystems. Glock is based in Georgia. The ammunition makers are based in Minnesota. Perv was one of two Portland police officers injured while firing the weapon in March, prompting Police Chief Derek Foxworth to order its recall. The .45 caliber Glock has been carried by 230 officers. The police bureau replaced them with 9mm Glocks. Perv's suit seeks $50,000 in compensatory damages, $3 million for pain and suffering, and $50 million in punitive damages. This from the Oregonian.
A federal grand jury has charged a former Clackamas County Sheriff's deputy with armed robbery of four businesses, including a bank, a pharmacy in Wilsonville District he was sworn to protect. Federal prosecutors and the FBI announced that David Verbos of Newburgh had been indicted in the gunpoint robberies of narcotics and cash stolen over 4 weeks late last year. If convicted, Verbos faces a prison sentence ranging from 30 years to life. Until this week, Verbos had been charged in Yamhill County Circuit Court only in the Bi-Mart robbery, although he had been identified as a subject in additional crimes. Felony accusations against sworn officers in Oregon are rare. Several local and federal authorities say they can't remember a similar case in Oregon. To protect him from inmates who might have encountered Verbos as a deputy, Verbos was jailed in Tillamook County on a $1 million bail. He will be transferred to federal custody in Portland for an arraignment Friday. There has been a surge of complaints from the local community against the Clackamas County Police, and tomorrow there will be a demonstration in Oregon City. Protesters are expected to demand that police violence stop. This from the Oregonian and other sources.
Washington is joining Oregon, California, and New Mexico in a lawsuit challenging the Bush administration's roadless lands ruling. The Bush administration wants to open roadless national forest lands to mining, logging, road building, and other development. Washington Governor Christine Gregoire said she had tried to avoid litigation. Gregoire asked the U.S. Agriculture Department for an expedited process that would enable the state to adopt the protections of former President Clinton's roadless rule. The Clinton roadless rule barred development on 58 million acres of national forest all across the country and 2 million acres in Washington state alone. The Bush administration announced plans last spring to give states a voice in the decision-making, with an 18-month span for land use recommendations, and the feds making the final call. Last week, Gregoire said she got the response to her petition, no. So the state is joining the lawsuit filed last summer in San Francisco. The Clinton administration rule was based on the idea that roadless areas which had escaped development, due mostly to their remoteness and ruggedness, were more valuable for clean water and wildlife habitat than timber. It covered almost a third of the 192 million acres of national forest land. The Bush administration created a new ruling after a federal judge in Wyoming, Dick Cheney's home state, declared the rule illegal. The Bush ruling gives governors a chance to propose whether roadless areas should be developed, but leaves the final decision up to the federal government. States are to work with Forest Service officials to devise management plans for individual forests. The revisions could allow road construction and commercial logging in roadless areas.
And here's more environmental news. The voluminous Puget Sound Salmon Recovery Plan proposes doubling spending on salmon recovery. This represents a commitment of more than $1.1 billion in federal, state, and local funds over the plan's first 10 years. The anticipated payoff is big jumps in Chinook populations throughout the region. The plan is the culmination of years of work spent developing strategies for rebuilding the Sound's Chinook, bull trout, and Hood Canal chum populations. In 1999, the fish were declared threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Support for the effort comes from diverse interests, but not everyone is on board, and even supporters aren't sure that there is enough money and momentum to get the job done. Key Seattle area tribes have been absent in the process, leading to concerns over the likelihood of success without their participation. There are also unresolved issues surrounding the negative effects of hatchery fish on wild fish recovery. Some critics have questioned the wisdom of investing millions in healing rivers flowing through urban areas rather than diverting money to pristine streams where recovery seems more likely. And no one is sure how climate change could disrupt the effort. A failure to adequately plan for a warmer world is one of the key criticisms raised at Wednesday's meeting. In recent years, warmer temperatures have already harmed Seattle area salmon populations passing through the Ballard Locks and into Lake Washington. Even though the plan was put together by local interest, the ultimate responsibility for safeguarding salmon to satisfy the Endangered Species Act falls to the National Marine Fisheries Service.
In San Francisco, a group of high school seniors and their parents filed a lawsuit this week against the State Department of Education and School Superintendent Jack O'Connell. They are claiming the California High School Exit Exam is illegal and discriminatory. Lead attorney Arturo Gonzalez said the lawsuit likely will expand to represent tens of thousands of students who have met all local requirements to graduate except passing both parts of the test, English and mathematics. Students in the class of 2006 are the first required to pass the two-part English and math test to receive a diploma. At the start of this school year, about 100,000 seniors had not passed at least one of the sections, more than one-fifth of the state's roughly 450,000 high school seniors. State officials have said they do not have updated figures, but they believe the number is much lower now. Gonzalez said the state failed to study alternatives for students who could not pass the test. He said that particularly applies to English learners. The lawsuit also claims the state is denying some students their fundamental right to an equal education. It was filed in San Francisco County Superior Court and names 10 students and their parents as plaintiffs. Defendants also include the state of California and the State Board of Education. Nationwide, 23 states have graduation exams and 4 more are phasing them in by 2012. Most states offer options for students with special needs and those who are learning English. Nearly all have confronted the same problems as California.
In Los Angeles yesterday, sheriff's deputies put down a fight involving nearly 200 jail inmates. It is the latest in a series of racially charged brawls at a Los Angeles County lockup. There were no major injuries. The fight between black and Hispanic inmates broke out shortly before 1 p.m. at two dorms in the east facility of Pitches Detention Center. Authorities quelled the brief melee using what's called a clear-out gas, officials said. No deputies were hurt. The fight erupted after sheriff's officials, hoping to ease tensions in the detention center, allowed clergy into a different section of the facility to talk with inmates. All seven Los Angeles County jails were on lockdown for a second day Thursday. There were five racially motivated fights Wednesday, the largest involving about 300 in a dorm at the center's north facility. 19 inmates were injured in the fighting on Wednesday, one critically. A section of the same detention center was the site of rioting Saturday between Hispanic and black inmates that killed one man and injured more than 100 others. This was followed by two jail melees Monday night.
The United States has won a preliminary victory in its World Trade Organization case against Europe's de facto moratorium on biotech crops and products. Matt Kay has more.
A WTO panel has ruled in a confidential preliminary report in a case brought in 2003 that the EU's effective moratorium on biotech crops violates world trade rules that require a science-based and expeditious review. The de facto GMO ban started in 98 with a cumbersome approval process stemmed from an EU consumer backlash against biotech crops, though the EU claims it lifted the ban in 2004, approving some corn varieties, but for animal, not human, consumption. Director of Research at the Minneapolis-based Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, Steve Supan, argues the safety issue is still an open question.
The ruling says that the panel did not examine whether biotech products in general are safe or not. And so the claims that are already being made by the U.S. Trade Representative that, you know, this shows that they're safe for use is contradicted already in the ruling.
At the Biotechnology Industry Organization, representing the makers of biotech products, spokesperson Lisa Dry argues GMOs are safe by some U.S. agency standards.
It's been determined by numerous scientific bodies around the world, including the National Academy of Science, the European Food Safety Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Environmental Protection Agency.
But despite the industry's claims of higher yields and pest resistance, several local farming communities in the U.S. have held elections to establish their towns as GMO-free zones. And across the Atlantic, Spain is the only EU member growing any significant amounts of GMO products, and biotech foods are virtually non-existent on grocery shelves. The WTO will issue a final report in a few months, and a possible EU appeal would take about 90 days, though the U.S. may also challenge an EU labeling requirement for foods made with biotech ingredients. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Kay in Washington.
The earliest official report of a New Orleans levee breach came at 8:30 a.m., hours after Hurricane Katrina roared ashore. Word of the possible breach surfaced at the White House less than 3 hours later at 11:13 a.m. In all, 28 federal, state, and local agencies reported levee failures on August 29th, according to a timeline of emails, situation updates, and weather reports, a litany at odds with the Bush administration's contention that it did not know the extent of the problem until much later. At the time, President Bush said, quote, "I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees." After the levees gave way, thousands of people were left stranded on rooftops and hundreds died in the flooding and its aftermath. Democrats say the new documents raise questions about whether the government moved quickly enough to rescue storm victims from massive flooding. The material was released in advance of a Senate hearing today at which Michael Brown, the former head of FEMA, was set to testify. Brown is widely considered the public face of the government's sluggish response to Katrina, but he signaled earlier this week that he was prepared to discuss his storm communications with President Bush and other top White House officials, a possible signal that his testimony would assign blame elsewhere. The White House has barred some top advisors and staffers from answering Senate investigators' questions about the administration's response, saying that certain discussions and documents must remain confidential. But Brown, who quit FEMA shortly after the storm and left the federal payroll November 2nd, is no longer covered by that confidentiality protection.
Scooter Libby told a federal grand jury that he had been authorized by Vice President Dick Cheney to disclose classified information to journalists. This to defend the Bush administration's use of false intelligence to launch war against Iraq. Sources also say Libby also indicated that he will offer what he will offer as a broad defense during his upcoming criminal trial. He is expected to claim that Vice President Cheney and other senior Bush administration officials had earlier encouraged and authorized him to share classified information with journalists to build public support for going to war. Later, after the war began in 2003, Cheney authorized Libby to release additional classified information, including details of the National Intelligence Document, to defend the administration's use of pre-war intelligence in making the case. Libby testified to the grand jury that he had been authorized to share parts of the information with journalists in the summer of 2003 as an effort to rebut charges then being made by former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson that the Bush administration had misrepresented intelligence to make public and make a public case for war. The new disclosure that Libby has claimed that the vice president and others in the White House had authorized him to release information is significant for several reasons. First, it significantly adds to a mounting body of information that Cheney played a central and personal role in directing efforts to counter claims by Wilson and other administration critics that the Bush administration had misused intelligence information to go to war with Iraq. Secondly, it raises additional questions about Libby's motives in concealing his role in leaking Plame's name to the press. This from the National Journal.
In These Times has reported a draft of a proposed regulations now causing widespread concern among state officials. It reveals plans to create a vast database of vital records to be centralized in Washington, and details measures that states must implement before next year's scheduled implementation. The draft lays out how some 60,000 towns and county officers must keep the birth and death records under lock and key and report all document requests to Washington. Individuals who show up in person will still be able to obtain their own birth certificates and, in some cases, the birth and death records of an immediate relative. And legitimate research institutions may be able to access files. But reporters and activists will not be allowed to fish through records. Many family members looking for genetic clues will be out of luck, and people wanting to trace adoptions will dead end. If you are homeless and need your own birth certificate, forget it. No address, no service. Aside from public health and privacy concerns, closing vital records incurs a steep, intangible cost. It undermines community in places where that healthy ethos still survives. This is from In These Times.
A band of Senate Republican holdouts reached agreement yesterday with the White House on changes in the Patriot Act designed to clear the way for passage of anti-terror legislation stalled in a dispute over civil liberties. Republican Senator John Sununu said the changes, quickly endorsed by at least two Democrats, would better protect civil liberties even as we give law enforcement important tools to conduct terrorism investigations. The White House embraced the deal even before Sununu and a few other senators outlined it. The compromise focused on three areas. Firstly, giving recipients of court-approved subpoenas for information in terrorist investigations the right to challenge a requirement that they refrain from telling anyone. Secondly, eliminating a requirement that an individual provide the FBI with the name of a lawyer consulted about a national security letter, which is a demand for records issued by investigators. And thirdly, clarifying that most libraries are not subject to demands in those letters for information about suspected terrorists. Republican Senator Larry Craig said that with the Senate and the White House now on the same page, quote, there will be no additional negotiations with the House, unquote. Reaction from Democrats was divided. The changes were worked out over several weeks in discussions that involved the lawmakers and the White House counsel, Harriet Myers.
President Bush has given details of what he said was a foiled al-Qaeda plot to fly a plane into the tallest buildings on the U.S. West Coast. At first, Bush called the building the Liberty Tower, but in fact, it was the Library Tower. And Bush also said the plan involved using shoe bombs to blow open the plane's cockpit door. The intended target was the 73-story Library Tower in Los Angeles, renamed the U.S. Bank Tower. The announcement comes as the White House is under pressure from some of the president's own supporters to be more aggressive in talking up the success of intelligence gathering, according to the BBC. In Los Angeles, Mayor Antonio Villagosa said the Associated Press news agency he had not been forewarned about the president's revelations. He said, quote, "I'm amazed that the president would make this announcement on national TV and not inform us of these details throughout the appropriate channels."
Anti-war activist whose son was killed in the conflict there put an end to speculation yesterday that she would launch a long-shot bid to become a U.S. senator from California. Sheehan, speaking in front of San Francisco City Hall, said she would not run for office. A campaign would have pitted her against California's senior senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat who's one of the state's most popular politicians. Although experts and polls suggest Feinstein, in office since 1992, will win re-election easily, a campaign by Sheehan would have provided her with a platform for her anti-war message. Sheehan has continued to stay in the news. Last week, police arrested her at the House of Representatives shortly before Bush gave his annual State of the Union address because she was wearing a T-shirt with an anti-war slogan. This, according to Reuters.
At least three teachers in the country have filed lawsuits against their employers since the beginning of the war, claiming the First Amendment rights were violated after they were fired for what they said was an opposition to the war. So far, one case has been settled out of court in favor of the teacher. In 2004, former New Mexico high school teacher Bill Nevins received a $205,000 settlement from the Rio Rancho School District. A year earlier, one of his students recited a poem over the school's intercom system that questioned the war in Iraq. Nevins, a 10th grade humanities teacher, was also the coach of the Rio Rancho High School poetry team. His contract was terminated within months of the incident. In November 2005, Alan Teams, an associate professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, filed a lawsuit against the college after he failed to get tenure. Teams said that he would post the body count of U.S. soldiers and Iraqi civilians next to a bulletin board filled with pro-military imagery, which included the words, "Operations Iraqi Freedom," next to a picture of the burning Twin Towers. In the lawsuit, Teams claimed he was warned by the department chair that he would not get tenure if he continued posting the body count next to the pro-war bulletin board. His last day at the college is in May, and he's been looking for work for several months with no luck. He has no regrets about what he did. During the first war in Iraq, high school teacher and wrestling coach Jim Lowe opposed plans for a ceremony supporting the war in Iraq to be held before a wrestling match. When the ceremony continued as planned, Lowe walked out of the building, delegating his coaching duties to an assistant. When his contract was terminated 2 months later, Lowe sued the Lakeland Union High School District in Minocqua, claiming his First Amendment free speech rights had been violated. He subsequently received a settlement of $140,000 from the Northwest Wisconsin School District.
According to the New York Times, more than three dozen energy companies fell nearly $500 million behind last year on royalty payments they owed for oil and gas extracted from public land. While most of that money was later turned over after the government demanded payment, almost $60 million remains in dispute. The companies, which included major producers like Chevron, Shell, and ConocoPhillips, had claimed lucrative government incentives for drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, even though the incentives were not supposed to be available if market prices climbed above certain threshold levels. The Interior Department identified 41 companies that incorrectly claimed nearly $500 million in the royalty relief during 2004 when prices for both oil and gas climbed to records. The Interior Department said that 38 of the 41 companies quickly paid $435 million in back royalties after it sent out warning letters months after the money should have been paid. But three companies, Kerr-McGee, Forest Oil, and Egypt, continued to protest $58 million. Indeed, Kerr-McGee officials suggested that they plan to challenge the government's legal authority to impose price thresholds in the first place. Royalty payments for oil and gas extracted from federal territory have drawn increased attention from Congress since the New York Times reported last month that payments had not climbed in line with the huge increase in market prices.
Kidnapped American journalist Jill Carroll appeared in a video aired yesterday on a private Kuwaiti TV channel. In the video, Carroll appealed for her supporters to do whatever it takes to win her release and saying, quote, "There is a very short time." The 22-second video was aired on a private Kuwaiti channel and included audio unlike two previous videos of Carroll. The video was delivered earlier Thursday to Al-Ray's Baghdad office and was aired in its entirety. Hani Al-Srugi, an editor at the station, told the Associated Press it was accompanied by a letter written by the 28-year-old freelancer. The newscaster said in the air that the station would hand the letter over to authorities but did not specify whether they would give it to Kuwait or American officials. The station said it would not disclose the letter's contents. In Baghdad, a U.S. Embassy spokesman, Dennis Culkin, said that American authorities routinely do not comment on such tapes, especially before they have been authenticated.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said yesterday he would invite Hamas leaders to Moscow. The move opens a crack in a wall of U.S.-led opposition to dealing with the Palestinian election winner until it recognized Israel. Ismail Haniyeh, a senior Hamas official, said in Gaza that leaders of the group whose charter calls for Israel's destruction would be delighted to visit Russia if Putin tendered a formal invitation. In New York, Russia's UN ambassador, Andrew Denisov, told a news conference that a key item on any agenda for any talks with Hamas would be prevention and the stopping of all terror activities, as well as the group regarding Israel as an independent state, neighbor, and partner. Denisov also said Moscow would push for the rejection of radical views and positions which are inappropriate and tell Hamas to keep up the momentum of the peace process. Denisov said the Palestinian people did not deserve to be cut off from such funding and that stopping it would be counterproductive. A U.S. State Department official said Russia had not revealed Putin's plan to invite Hamas leaders at the quartet meeting.
That was the KBOO Morning News for Friday, February 10th, 2006. Portland area weather. Today, sunny and breezy. Highs 55 to 60, lows 30 to 35. Saturday, partly sunny, highs around 55. Saturday night, mostly cloudy, lows 35 to 40. Sunday, partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain. Highs 50 to 55 and a light wind. Thanks for joining us this morning for the KBOO's News. This morning's newscast was edited by Becca Bartleson and Chris Andre. Our engineer is Becca. The KBOO AM Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Jim Thompson. At 7:30, Andre and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Their topic is sexism, misogyny, and the objectification of women. At 9, it's Marlene's Electronic Salon with Marlena Smith. In the first hour of the show, Dr. Stephen Bailey has a special program on transitions. At 10, Marlena continues a series on using myth to interpret life with Michael Mead. At 10:30, she'll have a piece from Dave Emery of Spitfire Productions on the re-release of some old books. 11, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. Think you've got the stamina to get up this early in the morning? Well, come down and help out with a KBOO Morning News. Please contact Kathleen Stevenson at amnews@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 202. This is KBOO, your community radio station, in Portland on 90.7 FM, K264AA in Corvallis at 100.7, and K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. Have a lovely weekend.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Friday, February 10th. There is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that invites American audience to step across the royal threshold and witness firsthand artistic treasures that until now have lay hidden behind castle doors. This international exhibit is devoted to the great artistic wealth of the German House of Hesse that was constructed towards the end of the last century by the Empress Frederick of Germany. This is a rare opportunity to view such beautiful antiquities of historical significance and artistic excellence, which was brought about by continual collaborative efforts and devotion between the museum and the Hesse family. For more info, call 503-226-2811. Tickets are $15 adults, $13 seniors, PCC Sylvania's 6th annual production of the Vagina Monologues, sponsored by the Women's Resource Center. Showtimes are 8 p.m. on February 10th. And 11th, and at 2 p.m. on February 12th. Doors open 1 hour before the show. Tickets are $15 for general admission, $12 for students, and $10 for groups of 10 or more. They can be purchased at the PCC's Women's Resource Center and other books and through Ticketmaster. The goal of the Vagina Monologue is to raise awareness to stop violence against women and girls and to raise funds for our beneficiaries. The Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center, the PCC Illumination Project. There will be a silent auction before the shows on Friday and Saturday to benefit SMIRC, with performances in the lobby by local musicians Allie Haynes and M. Brownlow of The Swallows. Contact Jessica Almaroth or Jazz McGinnis at 503-977-8101. The Portland Community College is located at 12000 Southwest 49th at the Sylvania campus. One can see a new documentary called Broken Limbs, placed in Wenatchee, Washington, the apple capital of the world. This pastoral valley is in the heart of the Northwest. It has prospered for nearly a century and has home to the famed Washington apple. Apple orchardists by thousands are going out of business and thousands more await the dreaded letter from the bank. After his own father received such a letter, filmmaker Guy Evans sets out on a journey to find out what went wrong here in this natural Garden of Eden. Over the course of the filming, Evan witnesses small farmers struggling to compete. The future looks grim for the apple capital until Evans happens upon an entirely new breed of farmers, practitioners of a new model called sustainable agriculture. Broken Limbs explores these hopeful stirrings within agriculture, outlining ways in which any individual can play a role in saving America's farms. Sponsored by the UU Community for Earth, there will be a $5 suggested donation. This show is showing at the First Unitarian Church on 1011 Southwest 12th. For more info, call Barbara Ford at 503-282-0740 or visit the web at www.firstunitarianportland.org. Portland's own Rose Highbear is an author, producer, and project manager of the Wisdom of the Elders and many Native American oral history projects and events. She will speak about her traditional heritage as Dead Hitan Din and of the Caribou people, one of the seven matrilineal nations still subsisting today in the subarctic interior of Alaska. She may also share stories from her nearly completed biography of the late medicine man, Martin Highbear. Donations are $10 to $20. They are requested to support the elders, and no one will be turned away for lack of funds. This event is at the PSU Native American Student and Community Center on Southwest Broadway and Jackson. For more info, call 503-452-4483 or visit the web earthandspirit.org. That was Community Calendar. You're listening to KBOO, Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.